Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy. Free speech is a hot topic in today's world. We often see politics characterised as a culture war, with groups advocating for safe spaces and no platforming figures due to their political views. This has led to a divide in politics across the Western world. There are those who argue that it is right to censor what they see as harmful language, which in their view reinforces systemic structural biases against people based on race, gender and class. On the other hand, many people see free speech as a fundamental and inalienable right for every citizen which wishes to live in a free democratic society with a plurality of ideas and opinions. But is it just cultural forces in our schools, universities, and even at the workplace which are curtailing freedom of speech? Or are politicians also starting to enact legislation which is prohibiting speech unjustifiably from the top down? In an age of online extremism and terrorism, where is the right place to draw the line on the freedom to speak our mind? Last week, the IA released a new book authored by Dr. Jamie White, former research director at the Institute of Economic Affairs. In his book, Why Free Speech Matters, Jamie issued a rallying cry saying that those who prize free speech must once again defend it. I'm delighted to be joined by him in the IA studio today to discuss his work. And I'm also joined by Dr. Christian Niemitz, head of political economy at the IA, who himself is interested in cultural issues related to freedom of speech. So welcome to both of you. Jamie, could you start by setting out why you decided to write about free speech and summarise the book's central argument?
Well, free speech is a hot topic at the moment. In two respects, there are some laws that there's one very important law before Parliament now, a bill called the Online Safety Bill, which if passed, and it almost certainly will be, will give the government control of social media companies' content moderation policies. I think this is a terrible violation of general principles regarding free speech. The other thing that's going on is there's a lot of cancel culture has taken off, and there's a kind of social stifling of speech. Now, my book actually does not concern that. Christian will lament this fact in a second.
I absolutely will.
It's just about the legal issue. Now, so the legal issue is this. Everybody believes in freedom of speech within limits. That's what everybody says, right? Whatever your view on free speech actually is, you say that you believe in it within the proper limits. So the question is, what are those proper limits? And what my book attempts to do is to come up with a principle that says when speech is properly restricted by law and when it isn't. And the central, that principle is this, that, well, I'll get to it in two steps. What you're trying to do is prevent harm with speech. But the problem is that the prevention of harm by stifling free speech itself is harmful. And it's harmful. There are two very important functions of free speech, so important that the law must not interfere with them. And that is that free speech helps to advance knowledge through, you know, the process we're all aware, you know, familiar with, the scientific approach. People put forward big new ideas and then they get argued about. Free speech is very important to that process. It's also very important to the democratic process of holding the powerful to account. Now, many restrictions on free speech, the conventional ones that everybody goes along with, like you shouldn't be allowed to commit fraud or perjury or incitement to murder, they're all fine, right? Because they don't interfere with free speech doing its important two jobs that I just mentioned. Blasphemy laws do, because they interfere with the expression of scientific ideas that are contrary to religion. And so this is a kind of test. And as I work through the book, I arrive at a principle which is pretty simple, actually, which is that there should be no prohibitions on the expression of an idea. Ultimately, where I end up with, and I can explain this further later if need be, is that no law should prohibit speech simply on the basis of the idea being expressed. So perjury and fraud and incitement, these are all crimes that occur, that speech is involved in them, but it's not the idea being expressed that's illegal. It's saying certain things under certain circumstances. For example, when they're false and you're in court, when there's an angry mob in front of you, and so on. So they don't actually restrict the expression of ideas in themselves, and no law should do that.
And opening on that, it's why is it that such a critical part of our democratic system constantly needs defending? Is it a misunderstanding of the benefits that you've briefly talked about? But I'd appreciate if you could maybe go into in a bit more detail of, you know, why freedom of speech is so essential.
Well,
to
the production of knowledge, it's essential because it's probably the best way to explain this is with examples. Suppose that we had a law that said, that prohibited the expression of harmful ideas, dangerous ideas. That's the kind of thing that many people nowadays want. Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, wants such laws. Well, when Darwin published his book, The Origin of Species, that was a dangerous idea. It was widely considered a very dangerous idea. Why? Because it helped to undermine the Christian myth of the relationship between man and God, and many people believed that that was the foundation of morality. And if you undermined religion, you undermined morality, and we would have social breakdown. It was a very dangerous idea. It would have been prohibited if such laws had existed. I can hardly think of any big new idea that wouldn't be deemed dangerous, especially likely to be deemed dangerous by the authorities. Because remember, the people in power, they're in power with things as they now are. So they are inherently opposed to radical change in society. And big new ideas promise radical change. I mean, all the major scientific breakthroughs have led to radical changes in society. So they'd be deemed dangerous. They'd probably also be deemed offensive. Many people found Darwin's ideas offensive. The idea of evolution offended, you're descended from a fish. That a lot of people found that an offensive idea. So again, if you had laws prohibiting the expression of offensive ideas, science would be stifled. It doesn't matter, by the way. I'm not advocating the view that some people have, which is that if you have free debate, error is driven from the field. That's clearly untrue. We have pretty free debate now, and there's lots of craziness out there. I'm not concerned with eliminating craziness. I'm concerned with the freedom required for the top thinkers to go about doing their business, because that's what human progress has depended on. So that's, I think, should be self-explanatory. There's quite a good book, I think. It's called Kindly Inquisitors by a chap called Jonathan Rauch. And he talks about what he calls liberal science. We have this system that's produced all this progress that we've enjoyed over the last 500 years is what he calls liberal science. And liberal science is inquiry conducted without authority. There's no authority involved. It's a competition of ideas and of ideas with reality in the experimental method. And the idea that there's free speech is, in a way, the idea that there's no place for authority in discovering the truth. So it's central to this way that we proceed in inquiry in the modern world. And when it comes to political scrutiny, I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, in the online safety bill, there's a clause where they haven't said yet what the harms that they're trying to protect people from are. Oddly, the bill doesn't specify what the harms are. It just says that the Secretary of State for Culture will specify at a later date. But there's been a document, a preparatory document to the bill, and one of the harms that it mentioned was threats to the British way of life. That's actually specified. Well, what doesn't threaten the British way of life if it's a big and interesting new idea? And in particular, think how this could be used in politics. I mean, I think that Jeremy Corbyn, had he got elected, would have changed the British way of life to some extent, and certainly any radical political party that got elected would change the British way of life. Will the online safety bill mean that they can't be heard? Is that the idea here? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it hasn't been tested in the courts, but it's an outrageous idea. Again, you can see that if you try to, if you say we're going to shut up people with dangerous ideas or offensive ideas, that will allow the powerful to shield themselves from scrutiny.
I'll bring Christian in now. Why do you think that, I mean, Jeremy, in the book, it's a rallying cry, a defence to freedom of speech again. Why do you think we're constantly having to make the case of freedom of speech when it seems so obvious?
Yes, it should be obvious enough. And I think at an abstract level, it is quite well understood. That's why there is nobody who says, I'm against free speech. You never meet someone who rejects the very principle. Everyone claims to be in favor of free speech. What you often hear is, of course, I'm pro-free speech, but. What people who are in favor of censorship would often do is, for example, they would say, yes, of course, we should have freedom of speech, but this implies that everyone in society, all groups, are equally powerful, but that isn't true. We have this power imbalance. We have issues of structural power. We have oppressor groups and oppressed groups. And if you just give them free speech, then the oppressors would just use that freedom to even further oppress the oppressed groups. And therefore, you need some restrictions to level the playing field, would rationalize it in that way. So I think what happens is that the nature of censorship has changed over the years. Historically, the dangers to freedom of expression came in the way that Jamie described. It was ruling elites using speech restrictions to protect themselves from criticism, either criticism of themselves, the people in charge directly, let's say under Saddam Hussein, if you had joked about him, you would have been disappeared. Or in other regimes, it would have been criticizing the ruling ideology. So let's say in East Germany, you were in principle allowed to criticize individual people in the Socialist Unity Party, in the leadership, but if you had criticized Marxism as such, then you would have been in trouble. So it was that kind of thing. The ruling elites using limits on freedom of expression to shield themselves, protect themselves. But that's not really what happens now. Now what we have is speech codes revolve around sacralized victim groups. That's what this is all about. You can't criticize the government. And if they try to use this British way of life thing in order to clamp down on their critics, I think that wouldn't work. That would not stand up. There would be massive resistance and the courts wouldn't have it. It's not that free speech nowadays is used to clamp down on dissent of the government as such. It really is a form of, well, I've long had held the view that woke progressive ideas have become a form of a status symbol. A woke opinion is a status symbol in the way that in previous decades a Rolex watch or a Ferrari would have been. And if you use it in that way, if you use your ideas for status signaling, then one implication of this is that it gets more extreme. If everyone around you is progressive, you have to be even more progressive. And I think one way in which you can do this if everyone basically agrees that we should be tolerant and so on, is that you say you don't just disagree with an idea that you consider offensive, because that's standard. Everyone disagrees with something that's considered offensive. But you want to go even further. You want to emphasize, no, I don't just disagree. I'm so disgusted. Mm. I want to shut this down completely. And that's why it has to get this extreme. And therefore you get this urge to censor.
I agree with you that it's not, that as things stand, there's very little chance that criticism of the government is going to be restricted. But I think it was interesting what you said. You said there was, in the past, it was criticism of the government or of the dominant ideology. And there may be an element of that going on now. That's to say, you know, you saw the anxiety caused by the question about do only women have cervixes? And, you know, many people in the Labour Party found this a terribly difficult question to answer. And why? You know, why are they so scared? Well, because there's a dominant ideology now, which is, you know, the kind of stuff where, that for example, gender is a matter of choice or something like that. And people are very keen to protect that ideology. And I think speech limitations, I mean, I can imagine it soon being regarded as hate speech to say that only women have cervixes. I mean, this isn't yet I don't think the law currently is applied to make that illegal, but I can easily imagine that happening. And it certainly, it does seem to be being used at the moment to defend an ideology. It's not necessarily the ideology of the Tory party or the government, but it is in defense of an ideology.
Yeah, okay. In that sense, it's more in line with the conventional speech restriction. Just one quick point. Mm-hmm. I'd also say that the idea that we tolerate opponents is also quite an unnatural one. We grew up in liberal democracies. For us, this is relatively normal and the way it should be. But in human history, more broadly, this was a brief period for centuries, for thousands of years. It hasn't been like that. The norm was that you have a dominant group in charge. When you have a clannish society or whatever, when a tribal society, you have one tribe or a tribal leader, a clan that comes on top, and they suppress dissent. And that's been the normal way for most of human history. And then we've had this weird period of maybe 200 years in which ideas of toleration and freedom of expression and peaceful dissent came along. And the results have been fantastic. We owe our entire prosperity to that and the freedoms that we enjoy. But we have to bear in mind that human nature isn't like that. The urge is to stifle dissent when you can. And in the same way in which, let's say, the rule of law is counterintuitive. If somebody does you something wrong, the urge is to retaliate and do something against that person, not to go to a court and go through all the motions. These are things that we have to consciously learn, and we have to restrain our impulses in order to make that work. And in the case of freedom of expression, for a long time, the dominant political currents were apparently happy to go along with that. And now maybe this is just a reversal to normal. We now have a group that is dominant and that remembers, actually, why should we tolerate the opposition? We can crush dissent. Why shouldn't we do it?
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting that we recorded a podcast a few months ago on the Frankfurt School, and this idea of these structures that exist and in society, and the idea that people advocate for the censorship of speech because they believe it will reinforce these biases against people on race, gender, and class, and so forth. Jeremy, I'm interested to see what you think. Is this is the cultural aspect of this inspired by a dedicated ideology on the left, or is it spontaneous? Is it
well? There are ideas that have caught on on the left. I don't think they were widespread on the left 100 years ago, but they are now. And it's Christian summed them up to some extent. There's this idea that there are kind of structural injustices in society around groups. So some groups are weaker or disadvantaged. And that all the kinds of liberal principles that we would espouse, kind of universalism, this is all really just a racket for holding the weak down. And it's a cover. We make out like it's high mind and principled. In fact, it's just to assert the dominance of the white patriarchy. And so they think that we should abandon these liberal principles and instead engineer society in a way to counteract the injustices going on. And so they don't. It's not just freedom of speech. It's, of course, economic freedoms also. But it's the same rationale. I think that What's peculiar about these people is that it seems to me pretty clear that, A, our prosperity is based on the liberal framework that we've enjoyed over the last couple hundred years. Also, it seems to me that the great improvement in the lot of women, let's say, in particular, and of racial minorities is also due to the liberal cast of mind that we've had. I mean, often your principles, you don't live up to your principles at first. I mean, in the United States, you read the preamble to the Declaration of Independence. It's rather grand. And this was written by people with slaves. But there was always a tension between those liberal principles and some of the practices. And in the end, the principles won out. And I don't know what's really going on with these people who say they don't believe in liberal principles. I can't believe they don't believe in them. I think they must be up to something. But I don't know what it is exactly, except what they say it is.
So going back onto the online harms safety bill, after the tragic murder of Sir David Emmis, there was calls for a anonymity online to be removed.
Right.
Now, Victoria Hewson, head of regulatory affairs, responded to that in the Telegraph in an op-ed, and she argued that anonymity online is a vital part of freedom of expression. I'd like to get both your thoughts on that. Is anonymity online a good thing, especially if you would like to speak your mind in the environment that we are now?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And this is really a cynical move. This has absolutely nothing to do with this murder. And this is an individual tragedy. And we now see people who were probably previously already in favor of cracking down on anonymity for some reason, now using that as an excuse to rapidly push through legal changes. And it is particularly in the current climate, given that we have this widespread cancel culture, I can absolutely see why someone would want to be anonymous.
What's the alleged connection between anonymity online and the murder of that MP? I don't even get the alleged connection.
Well, it was even before we knew anything about the suspect. You had people linking this in some way to abuse that MPs get online. And which this particular MP, as far as I know, didn't. He was not very active on Twitter and tweeted fairly generic MP stuff about his constituency.
It seems after the Christchurch mosque massacre, Jacinda Ardern introduced some speech legislation, and I think more is coming. And nobody ever showed any connection between the murder and the speech that was going to be disallowed. I think you're right; it's completely cynical, but it's also bizarre. I mean, I don't even get what the alleged connection is. Politicians were assassinated long before social media came around. This idea seems to be building up that hatred, animosities and hatreds and so on, wouldn't exist if people didn't hear bad stuff on social media and so on. And I just don't believe it for a second. I mean, the history of humanity is just a history of hatred.
Well, the different forms of hatred. There is greater political polarization. That I wouldn't dispute compared to, say, 20 years ago. But it just has nothing to do with this murder. This wasn't someone who strongly disagreed with the policies of that politician and therefore murdered him. This was something completely different. It wasn't someone who was whipped up by an anonymous online mob or something. There really was no connection. That's why this idea just came up very quickly, even before we knew anything about the case.
There may be some more polarization, but does it amount to hate? I mean, I suppose there are some of those kind of people who yell Tory scum and so on, but I wouldn't say that. I know quite a few Tories, and I don't think any of them hate Labour voters.
No, it's very much in one direction.
So, Christian, you interviewed Jeremy when we launched the book at the IA at Lord North Street. And there seemed to be a little bit of a difference on where you thought the main attack from free speech was coming from. Jeremy, you sort of expressed that it was a top-down in the corridors of power. But, I mean, you acknowledged as well there is a cultural aspect to it.
Well,
but
there is a cultural. I mean, I don't think Christian and I do disagree, actually. I just think he wants me to do something I don't want to do. So Christian believes that the problems are mainly cultural and that the legal moves, such as the online safety bill, are a consequence of the cultural shifts. And I think I agree with him about both of those ideas. But, you know, I really wanted to ask, so for my own sake, in a way, I'd never really worked it through before, what is the principle that should be applied when deciding on legal speech restrictions? So it's just a division of labor issue between Christian and me. I don't want to engage in the culture war. I don't enjoy it. Christian does enjoy it, I think. And so why don't we just do what we both like doing and what we're good at? I mean, I'm not as good at poking fun at lefties as as Christian is.
Well, who is? Yeah, I think that the issue here is that for a long time, we liberals have quite deliberately made a point of not commenting on the activities of private individuals and private organizations, because we thought that that would distract from our own message. We like to keep things at the meter level and say, these are the rules of the game. You should have a right to do this. You should not have a right to do that. You should be free to do what you like, as long as you're not violating somebody else's rights. And the content of particular activities, you can just talk about the rules of the game. And for a long time, we liberals have made a point of that, and if you stick to that, it would be quite hard to criticize cancel culture, because it's all in the private sector. It's all driven by mobs, but also they are not government funded, they are not acting, they don't themselves have coercive power. It's just that they put a lot of pressure on employers, universities, and so on. And if you just talk about general rules of the game and property rights, then you can't say very much about that, because then you can say, well, okay, it's not illegitimate to join an online mob, and it's not illegitimate for an employer to fire someone when they come under pressure from a group boycotting them. It's just that, I mean, this has sometimes, I think we've sometimes overdone it with this speaking purely from the meta level and only talking about the rules of the game, not commenting on what private organizations or individuals do, because you can of course recognize that somebody has the right to act in a particular way, but you can still have opinions on things. You can still judge people for what they do, even if you don't want to ban their activities. And I mean, this has reached a stage at some, I've noticed this several times when I commented on something that a private company does say that I disapprove of. I get someone replying, yeah, but that's private property. They have a right to do that. And even though it should be perfectly clear, I'm not saying they should be banned, but I can still have opinions. And I think what we need now is a judgmental liberalism. We shouldn't just say, yes, companies have a right to have an internal speech code. Companies have a right to, or universities have a right to expel you for if you say something that goes against their principles. We should also say, yes, they have a right, but they shouldn't use it. And we should use our platforms, such as they are, to put some pressure on people who and organizations who cave into the woke mob too quickly. And because otherwise you get this mob culture where these are the people who are most motivated, care most about the issue, and that can really totally change the climate. I mean, I want to live in a society where the legal situation is, I'd say, exactly the way Jamie describes in his book, where those are the principles of freedom of expression, and that would be that. But I'd also like to live in a society where people don't have to live in fear of being ostracized and fired for a silly joke they made 10 years ago. And what happens now is there was, for example, a story the other day about a bunch of students who got kicked out of university for some jokes they made in a private WhatsApp group. So you have someone in that group who takes a screenshot and sends it to the university, and they say, this is totally unacceptable, this is outrageous, you get kids, 20-year-olds, who get expelled from university.
I agree, that's absolutely outrageous, and I also wish I lived in a tolerant society. And I like your phrase, judgmental liberalism. I think that's very good, and we should bang on about it. I've got no objection to anything Christian just said. I just wasn't doing that in my book. I'll write another one. I remember once there was a philosophy seminar I was at, and some guy stood up and made a complaint about the paper because he hadn't done this and that and the other. And it was very peculiar because the talk he'd given wasn't about those things. And somebody else as a joke stood up and says, yes, and I'm very disappointed too because I was hoping you were going to tell me the winning lotto numbers. So it's just, you know...
I wouldn't accept that analogy. I mean, if you take the online safety bill, this is the sort of thing where if we had a different cultural climate... I would be far less bothered about that because then I could imagine that, okay, maybe this is a law that exists somewhere in the books, but it will never be applied. But the way things are, even though I haven't read the bill, I've just read comments about it, but it's already, I think, pretty clear what it will mean in practice. You will have a lot of woke progressives saying, this causes harm and this is unacceptable, this should be taken down. And you will have social media companies preemptively censoring because they think, well, we don't want to maximize accuracy here. We want to play it safe. We want to avoid the risk of having to pay a hefty fine. And they will therefore err on the side of caution. And it will be demand-driven. They will only act when somebody complains. And in practice, who does the complaining nowadays? Well, it's only woke progressives.
So Ofcom is going to administer it. And the threat, which I think Christian's right, is that Ofcom will get captured by a certain kind of ideology. And because, of course, all the Ofcom will be receiving the complaints now. And then they will enforce it. And I think Christian's also dead right. That the social media companies will have to be very cautious, so their algorithms and all the kind of will build in hyper caution, I would imagine. Because, by the way, the penalty if they fail in their duty of care is a 10% a fine of 10% of their global revenues, not 10% of their UK profits, 10% of their global revenues. It would wipe out their profit. I mean, if they've got normal profit margins, that would wipe them out for the year. So it's a very serious piece of legislation. But again, it's a terrible piece of legislation, partly for the reason Christian's just said, which is that we've really no idea what it will and will not eliminate. That will depend entirely on the discretion of the officials running it. And the law shouldn't really be like that. In fact, the companies will not... The social media firms will not be operating under the rule of law at all. It will be entirely arbitrary interventions by Ofcom. And that's a terrible development in British law. There are more and more of these. The general anti-avoidance rule in taxation effectively eliminated the rule of law in tax matters and leaves it entirely to the judgment of tax collectors whether or not you have obeyed the spirit of the law. I don't think we learn of the rule of law in the UK anymore, really.
Well, interesting, going on to that, the US Constitution often comes up in issues of freedom of speech. Obviously, the book talks about a limiting principle. Mm-hmm. Bit of blue sky thinking now. Is the solution to protecting freedom of speech to enact legislation that does outright defend freedom of speech, just like the First Amendment in America?
It's tricky under... I mean, that's a constitutional amendment, the First Amendment. And we don't have that kind of constitution.
No, of course, but it could be like the Bill of Rights in 1689. Right.
Well, I think that's a bigger question about whether or not we should try to protect the liberties of British citizens by way of some kind of quasi-constitutional initiative. That's a debate for legal scholars. I'm not convinced one way or the other on that question. I will say this though: the First Amendment in the United States does protect freedom of speech there very effectively, and one of the reasons is that the judges have interpreted it as a very, very strict protection of freedom of speech. You could never pass an online safety bill in the United States. It would clearly be struck down by the Supreme Court. There's the Communications Decency Act of 1996. That's not constitutional. Section 230 of it says that social media companies, what do they call them? Interactive online companies or something like that, but they basically mean social media, are not publishers. So they're more like the way to think about it is more like they're notice boards, and people pin the notices up. The owner of the notice board hasn't published it, and therefore isn't liable for defamation. If they were, they would and it's all over, right? I mean, you cannot have social media companies if they're liable for the defamatory things said on them, because it's just defamation day in and day out on social media. So that clause is vital for the functioning of the social media companies. Now, interestingly, both Biden has expressed dismay about it, because he thinks it lets social media companies off the hook when it comes to protecting users from harm when in their content policies, content moderation policies. Trump also doesn't like it, because Trump thinks that it allows them too much leeway in terms of political bias in their content moderation policies. Now, and as both have wanted to modify or abolish Clause 230, interestingly, the Online Safety Bill in the UK tries to simultaneously do what Biden wants and what Trump wants. So it has this duty of care stuff about protecting the users of it from harm. That's what Biden wants. But it also has a requirement on social media companies to not remove politically valuable speech or something like that, right? Again, you know, who is going to be the judge of this? It's an incredible idea that the government should get involved in deciding this stuff. The government's going to decide what's politically important speech, what should be on there, what shouldn't be on there. I mean, it is an outrageous piece of legislation.
Which makes it all the more ironic that our version of it, Online Safety Bill, that is brought in by a conservative government. They must be thinking that they can somehow use this against their opponents. And it's almost cute that conservatives think that. It's totally obvious that this will be used in 99% of cases against conservatives of one variety or another. Because it will be all demand driven, and then it will have to be in an ad hoc way.
They keep forgetting, too, that they're not going to be the government forever. You see this all the time with Tories. They do a little power grab because they want their particular agenda. So they make a structural change for the sake of their agenda. Thatcher did it when she centralized power. She diminished the independence and power of the local governments and centralized it because she didn't like those local governments.
Right? Yeah.
But now you've centralized power, and then Labour comes in, you know, and now and they've got more power, and they're just making this mistake again. I mean, imagine how Labour would use this bill. Terrible.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for. But thank you to my guest, Dr. Jeremy White, author of Why Free Speech Matters. A link to the book is included in the show notes. And thank you to Dr. Christian Niemitz, who is head of political economy at the Institute of Economic Affairs. I hope you'll join us again next week. Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify, or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IEA London. If you want to help contribute to the IEA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.